humble and not conceited, satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none true anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and outwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu.
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 Always something new.
Okie dokie, here we go.
There is many questions this evening. So, not that many. So if I'm fast with the questions, please understand that we have to get through a lot of questions. So here we go. Feeding wildlife with leftover lunch might seem like a kind act, but it is not a good idea. The wildlife will soon get addicted to human food and then turn fat and ugly. I'm a wild monk. Left over lunch. Yes, sometimes it's not a good thing to do, but sometimes, you know, the animals, we're not really supposed to, but the monks over who take their food back to their huts, they feed the animals there. And the animals seem to be very healthy and very happy. And they haven't got fat. It is a very beautiful thing to do. It makes the animals happy, makes us happy. Sometimes the scientists would say, oh, it's bad for the animals. Now let the animals decide. Please advise, what is the process of becoming a monk? You listen to one of my talks, and then it's inevitable. That's the process. So So look, if a person wants to ordain as a monk, sometimes, again, it's a process. You know, once you start getting interested in the sutras or the Buddhism, the meditation, it becomes inevitable. If any of you read the sutras, you see the process all starts with you listen to a talk and you get inspired. That's what it says. And all the other stuff which you're supposed to do, going to find a monastery, to find a teacher, to do this training and do that training, that's not what starts you becoming a monk. If you like, the ordination starts, it becomes inevitable once you've listened to a good talk and understood something. Because look, with all the best wishes in the world, there are plenty of doctors in this world, there's plenty of nurses, there's plenty of business people, there's plenty of wives and husbands, there's plenty of kids. But you know, what don't we have enough of in our world? And? Exactly. That's why you have to keep importing monks from Australia and from other countries to Singapore. Can't you actually grow your own and be self-sufficient? So eventually, you know, you become monks and nuns. And how that actually works, you know, you have a seed from another monastery first of all. So you know, you go over there just like this place started. I went over to Thailand, you know, learnt my stuff over there, became a monk, and then came to Australia to be a monk. And so that's actually how what happened. So you need a one of you to actually ordain over in here in maybe Bodhinyana or Dhammasara. You know, learn the ropes, become independent, and then you can go back and start something in Singapore. And I was just talking with Angie earlier, because sometimes the problem with starting a monastery in a place like Singapore, there's no land for that, unless you're mega wealthy, buy a golf course and turn the golf course into a meditation monastery. And they make beautiful monasteries if you get a golf course. And how many golf courses are there in Singapore? Many of them. So anyone who's really, really, really wealthy, just go and buy a golf course and just put a few huts in there, and then we, you know, the clubhouse can be the meditation hall. And you know, you've got your monastery, Forest Monastery in Singapore, but sometimes that's difficult. So often you have to think outside the box. When you say a forest monastery, now this is a corruption of the original term, which was Aranya. Now, if you ever look at the sutras and learn a little bit of Pali, these are called the Aranya. And ever since the time of the Buddha, there was people called the Aranyawasi. These were the monks who lived outside of the cities. Aranya means, you know, not ruled, you know, not of the king. It means the wilderness areas. So to think that an Aranya monk, it has to live in a forest, you know, it can be a desert, it can be mountains. Basically, it's away from the towns and the cities and the villages. That was the original meaning. You don't have to have a tree. So when you understand what the idea of a forest monastery was, these were monks who lived in these places because it meant not many people would go to see them. They'd have to live very simply. In the cities, it was very convenient. People would come and they'd give you lots of stuff. You'd become rich and wealthy. And when I was a young monk, the forest monasteries in places like Thailand were very poor, because all the people went to the city monasteries and gave them so much stuff. And then those city monasteries, the village monasteries, became corrupt. You know, people lived in such luxury there. And so the people in Thailand, they started to get fed up with the city monks. So they went to the forest monks, where the monks were living very simply. And then they started giving them lots of money. And now, you know, the forest monks are all corrupt. So be careful there. Now, what is the whole idea of a forest tradition? The whole idea of the forest tradition is simplicity, having few possessions, spending time doing lots of meditation and not building fancy monasteries. And I've mentioned this to you in public talks. Please do not give this monastery too much money. Not many monks say that. They say, oh, we need more money. We need this, we need that, we need that. And I go on and say, no, you'll spoil us. If there's something needed, a project, fine. and make sure that if you do give any funds to a monastery, go and have a look at it first of all. What do they use their funds for? And that's one of the reasons. You know, if you haven't seen it yet, I'm sure you will, see where I live. You've been meditating there for the past few days. That is my inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies. Could you go and meditate in the Dalai Lama's bedroom? You can in mine. You know, you've been doing it for the last few days. Now, did you hit your head on the chandelier in my cave? Was there a chandelier there? No, you know, you were staying in there the last few days. Yes, you were. Don't look around, you know. Oh, no, sorry. No, not you. It's Yutong, sorry. Yeah. Did you hit the head on a chandelier? Is it simple? So go and have a look. That's where I live. That's my home.
It's very cold,
isn't it? Very cold. It's not cold, it's cool. You go in there to chill out. And so sometimes I made a resolution a long time ago as a young monk. Doesn't matter how famous I get, I will always try and live in a place which is more simple than the poorest of my supporters. So if you live in a home which is more poor than my cave, then I'm in big trouble. I have to try and get rid of something. That was actually my resolution. So, you know, because you see that people work really hard, they give donations to monks and nuns, and those monks and nuns live much more comfortably than you do. Should be the other way around. They should be giving donations to you. Now, I remember once in Penang, just people telling me there that they invited some monks, you know, for a meal. And then during the meal, one of the monks' mobile phones rang. Now, we don't have mobile phones as monks. That's one of our, you know, in-house rules. So, you know, we don't have mobile phones. But it was not having a monk having a mobile phone, that when he got it out, it was the latest, most expensive model. And the hosts, you know, in Penang, there's lots of rich people there, they said, wow, even we haven't got a phone like this. Where does that monk get all his funds from? And so they asked the monk, sort of, can you invite us for a meal at your house? Because, you know, you can give us dana, you're wealthier than we are. Now, there's something about, you know, if you see monks living in great wealth, there's something wrong with that. There's something, you know, it's not supposed to be like. So the Aranya tradition was supposed to be the simple monks, devoted not to fame, not to getting on in the world, you know, but actually to living simply and peacefully. And, you know, afterwards, what does a monk need? Does a monk need a mobile phone? No, I do have a tablet that I use for emails when I go overseas. But I don't have a mobile phone. I don't have an expensive watch. And you know, that gives people faith, because that's what a monk is supposed to do, leading by example. So this is one of the reasons why, that when you become a monk, choose a simple monastery. And if it is in Singapore, I'm suggesting if you want a monastery, then think outside the box. You can get a couple of top floors of a big condo. And I say that because many years ago, I was going to get a ticket on Thai Airways. I do apologize, I flew Thai before I discovered Singapore. And next to their office in Perth on some high rise, there was an empty office. And I just went in there for a few minutes because, you know, I think I had a few minutes to kill. It was an empty office, the door was open. I sat down and meditated, and it was totally silent in there. Because, you know, it was high up, the windows were double glazed, there was no noise of traffic, no noise of aircraft, no noise of people. And I thought, wow, this is more silent than a forest monastery. And I thought, well, the whole purpose of a forest monastery is to actually be silent, have lots of places to meditate, and just be able to disappear. And do you know that you can disappear in the city much easier than you can disappear in a forest? In a city, you just, no one knows you're there. In a forest, you have to contact your neighbors, there's a bushfire brigade, there's all these other things you have to do. But in a big condo, you can vanish. You can really be a hermit in the city much easier than in the forest these days. So sometimes I think, well, if you want a forest monastery and a runya, a place where good monks can stay in Singapore, you don't need much land. Top floors of a condo. Just make it very simple. Nice little caves like mine. How many of those little caves can you build on the top floor of a condo? Little walking meditation path. Just let the monks stay there, meditate, become enlightened. Just come and teach every now and again. What more do you want? Interesting idea. Just try and think outside the box. You know, the sort of get the essential teachings of being a monk or being a nun. And can you fit that into a different environment? Because there's hardly any forest left these days. There's hardly any wilderness areas. And all the best forests, they get turned into resorts for tourists. And it's also that sometimes you wonder, you get into a nice virgin forest, and because you go there, other people go there, you're destroying it and driving the nature away as well. Somebody told me there was a picture of a monk who recently got killed in Thailand by an elephant. And this is poor old elephants, you know, that they've only got a little bit of land left. And now the forest monks, you know, we go in there because we want to live in nature. We want to live away from people. And we're sort of driving the animals out. So I try and think of a way outside the box, a different way of doing things. Maybe that might work, who knows? Anyway, to be a monk, once you've found a teacher in a monastery, a simple place which inspires you, and that's what you want to do, then, you know, you just try and become an anagarika. There's a 1 year, you know, you can see them in the back there, training to make sure two things that you want to be, to live, you know, this life. So, you know, they test themselves out and we can test them out. Because sometimes you get some crazy people want to be monks. No, literally, you know, some weirdos. Because, you know, they have this idea, you know, that, okay, you know, I'm in suffering, I just want to become a monk, you know, because, you know, no one else loves me, or they're running away from something, I don't know why. But because of that, you've got to really test them out, first of all. As, you know, the monks, we have to make sure they're okay. And they have to like being a monk, so it's a testing period for both. And then afterwards, they become a novice for another year, another bit of testing, wearing a brown robe, and then they can become a full monk and get trained, and eventually, what I'd always really hoped is the monks, actually some of them do, they go out from Bodhinyana Monastery to live in the, there's quite a few living in the jungles, or but not enough of them have really decided to go out and do their own monasteries, which is a bit of a shame. But you know, that basically I can understand why, they're having such a good time here, why go and have all the problems and troubles which I have. Who wants to be an abbot? You must have. The only reason I became an abbot, by the way, is I was number two, having a great time, and the senior monk at the time fell in love, disrobed and got married. Really unfair. But anyway, that's how you become a monk. And I just wanted to say about what the forest monk tradition really is. And it was one of simplicity, frugality, a lot of meditation, hardly any ceremonies, and just keep it as simple as possible. Anyway, the more efficient the teachings of Buddhism, the more people will become enlightened, and there will be less and less of human beings on this earth. Would this be the end of Buddhism? Please enlighten me. Wouldn't that be wonderful if there was less human beings on this earth? You know, we do more damage to this earth, this environment, than any other animal. Of all the animals in this world, we are the most dangerous. And there is too many of us. We all know that. Population, how many more people can you put in Singapore? Not that many, so what are you going to do? The Singapore government, you know, should ask maybe every third man or third woman to become a monk or a nun. And that will lower the population enormously. And they could subsidize because, you know, we're doing something good for the environment, you know, lessening the sort of the carbon footprint of Singapore. So, you know, monasteries should get carbon credits. Because apparently on the carbon economy these days, you get these carbon credits and, you know, you sell them, and that actually lowers your emissions and you fulfill all these Kyoto protocols and stuff. So, you know, that if you become sort of a monk or a nun, you get carbon credits for that, for Singapore, and so they can fulfill all the commitments under the Kyoto and other agreements to limit the effects of carbon change. Isn't that a good idea? Well, I think so, anyway. So that's very good. So there'll be less, when there's less people on this earth, the better it will be. That's what I think, anyway. Dear Ajahn, tomorrow is Friday, so are we going to have a payday for our meditation? Please leave the details of your bank account and our treasurer will raid it. Yeah, the payday, the check is in the mail. For those who have not got it, cheer up, it means you are on the management board, you get it on a monthly basis. Dear Ajahn Brahm, it is confirmed you are, what's this, is you are psychotic? Oh, psychic, it says. Not psychotic. That's why I started doing physics. I thought it was psychics. I didn't read it properly. Anyway, in this morning talk, you said, I don't need to get a doctorate, and you were looking at me when you said it. How did you know it was on my mind? What is a doctorate? It's called a PhD. You know what PhD stands for? This is one of the people in KL told me this had a PhD. PhD is an acronym. And it stands for permanent head damage. That's PhD. Oh, I shouldn't say that. And you said, I don't need to be afraid. I need to be more courageous. And you looked at me again. Of course, when you said, I don't need to be the most beautiful woman, you didn't look at me. Oh, what are you making out of this? Where is this going to end? I don't know. So I know you're not referring to me. Your talk is very inspiring and encouraged me to continue on the path. Thank you. You've got to be really careful who you look at. You've got to look at somebody. So don't take it seriously. I once heard that when you're enlightened, you will be dead within 7 days. Is this true? So actually, it is true. If you're a layperson and you get enlightened today, or this evening, I should have warned you about that. You should look at the fine print before you commit to these retreats. They should put that as a warning on the registration form. You have 7 days to become a monk or a nun, or that's it. And sometimes people say, you know, do you believe that? And I don't believe that, but I know it to be true. Why is that? It's because when you understand what enlightenment is, now one of the things you let go of is your will. There's no purpose to living as a layperson anymore. What are you doing it for? Nothing to do. You finish, it's like, you know, what's the point of working? You know, when you've got enough money and you know, you're not really doing sort of a good service to people, so you retire. You retire from samsara. You finish, nothing to do. But if you become a monk or a nun, there's a purpose for your life, to teach, to serve the Dhamma. Nothing else to do. So that's why that many people, if they become enlightened as a layperson, they will just, I want to ordain me. And that's what we do. If you find out your enlightenment, we've got 7 days, we'll fast track you. But it is, when you understand, you've got no choice in this. Your will, you know, the thing which runs you, is totally conditioned. And if you see the Dhamma, you can't do that anymore. It's impossible. So you just want to become a monk or a nun. And if there's some reason you can't do that, then you just disappear. Interesting question. Once you understand, if you get a few jhanas, you'll understand the answer to that question. I experienced rapture, but then no happiness arising. But my breath faded off slowly, leaving me with space-looking scene. I did see some lights here and there, but not enough to grow into a big and beautiful nimitta. Should I enjoy the peaceful scene or ignite some happiness? No, just enjoy the peaceful scene. Don't ignite anything. It will just ignite itself. Your job is just to be there and enjoy it. Be as content and happy as you like. Remember, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have, so the happiness doesn't arise. But when you stop wanting things, you're just so happy being here. Remember during the retreat telling the monks about some of the content moments of my life when I was a layperson. And there's one I always remember. I was maybe 13 years of age at school, and we had a half-day holiday at school. And I didn't have that much homework to complete. So instead of playing soccer with my friends in the school playground before lunch, I stayed in the classroom and finished all my homework, then had the school lunch, and then I was free to go. And as I walked out of that school in the afternoon, I had nothing to do, no appointments, no jobs to complete. And I realized this was happiness. I had nothing pressurizing me at all. And I was just so content that morning or that afternoon. Because what should I do? I don't care. I'm just going to walk and see where I get to. And I was only 13 at the time, but I had nothing I needed to do. Nothing I wanted. Content. And the other time I remember, I was working, you know, to save up some money during the vacation periods. Always had to work. And it was in London somewhere, and I had lunch, a few sandwiches, you know, in Hyde Park, you know, by the old Serpentine Lake in Hyde Park. It was a short walk from where I was working. And sometimes I'd just sit there and just watch the lake, not wanting anything, not afraid, not trying to get rid of things, not wanting anything, just being totally happy, just being there, you know, just being. And I remember those moments of contentment, of being so happy, where, you know, where you are, the people you are with, you know, the money you have, the clothes you're wearing, that you don't want anything else in the whole world. If you had a magic wand and could change things, or if you found a bottle and a genie came out and they said you have 3 wishes, and say, no, thank you. I'm happy enough. And that's contentment. That is the highest happiness. And it's there for you all the time. You just need to turn to it. Just not want anything. Content. And then you have this great surge of happiness. Because all the life you're searching, struggling, reaching out for something. And that's suffering. Just stop reaching out and just see what you have. And be so content here on a Thursday evening in Jhana Grove. Not very good meditation, who cares? Just content with where you are right now. And now, if you had a wish, what would you wish? Do you want jhanas? No, just I'm happy here. Would you like enlightenment? No, just I'm happy here. Would you like $1 billion US? No, I'm really happy here. Would you like your diseases overcome and be free of pain? No, I'm quite happy with what I've got. That is called contentment. And that is freedom. Totally at peace. There are 2 types of freedom in this world. Remember, this is another deep insight. The freedom of desire. To get what you want when you want, to go where you want, control your body, get rid of all the aches and pains and stuff like that. Freedom to do that. And that's not real freedom at all, because there's no end to that. But the freedom from desire. Sitting here, there's nothing you want in the whole world. It doesn't have to be perfect, pain-free. You don't need to be a billionaire. You don't need to have this wonderful lover to be totally content. Just happy being here. And when you have that, you have this beautiful sense of the freedom from desire, a taste of enlightenment, a moment when craving just pauses. You're just happy being here. That's And everyone's had moments like that, but they forget them. You know, maybe as a child, or you know, you go on some holiday somewhere, and you know, you've got nothing to do. You sit in Venice, or you sit in Rome somewhere, just to sit and have a nice cup of coffee. And you sit there with your cup of coffee in Rome and some sort of cafe. And think, wow, just in this moment, I don't want to be anywhere else in the whole world, just here. Just sitting down, doing nothing, just watching the people go by. Those are moments of contentment. That will teach you, if you remember those, what meditation is. What is actually wrong with ordination of nuns? Exactly. Nothing. Doesn't the Buddha ordain nuns? Yes, he did. And that was one of his life purposes. Now, his meaning, after he became enlightened, this fellow Mara, which I keep mentioning, he realized that he couldn't stop the Buddha being enlightened, so the Buddha was enlightened. So he used Plan B. And Plan B was, well done, you're enlightened. Now just don't teach other people, because that's tiring and difficult. Just know you're enlightened, well done, you can sit here and do nothing and just go and disappear. And the Buddha said, no, I will not disappear, I will not go yet. Until, he said, I've established a fourfold assembly and they are flourishing. Until I've established the Bhikkhu Sangha, the communities of monks, until they're many and flourishing with all the enlightened ones in it. Until I've, number two, established a Bhikkhuni Sangha, until they're flourishing and can be self-sustaining, until I've established the male lay followers, and they're flourishing, until I've established the male, the female lay followers, until they're many and flourishing in the world. Once they are all strong and flourishing, then I've done my job, then I can enter Parinibbana. And that was what the Buddha said, and that was his promise, and at the Chapala shrine, now, 3 months before the Buddha's Parinibbana, Mara came along and reminded him of his promise. He said, look, there's hundreds, thousands of monks and bhikkhunis and enlightened and anagamis, there's thousands of lay people, men and women following your teachings, stream winners and stuff, and that you've fulfilled your job. And the Buddha said, yeah, it's true. So he said, no, 3 months' time, I'll leave. The point was, that was his intention from the very beginning of his teaching career, to establish not just monks, but nuns. That was his goal, you know, just to get things going. So because of that, it's not there's something wrong with the ordination of nuns, there's something wrong with not ordaining nuns. There's something wrong with people who try and stop the ordination of nuns. There's people wrong with people who say, there are no nuns. They're right in front of you. No, 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 they don't exist. Behind a flashing white light is a tunnel. After the light stops flashing, I try to enter the tunnel, but I don't seem to be able to go in. That is a railway tunnel. The lights is a train is coming through. No, it's not a railway tunnel. Behind a flashing white light is a tunnel. After the light starts flashing, I try to enter the tunnel, but I don't seem to be able to go in. Why am I stuck at the entrance of the tunnel? Because you want to go in. Be content being on the outside, and then you go in. So it's all, if there's any, again, any block, hindrance to the progress of your meditation, there's a wanting there somewhere. You want something. That's why you stop. The leaf moves because of wanting, because of the wind of wanting. When the wind stops, the leaf becomes still. So if the leaf is moving, there's a wind there somewhere. If your mind doesn't progress deep into stillness, you want something. So you look, what do I want? What do I want? And you see it. I want that light. I want to progress. And then you stop it. This is conclusive proof that Michel was not the author of last night's notes. I'm sure the writer spoke for all of us in expressing gratitude to Michelle for going way beyond the call of duty in her tireless efforts in thinking, planning, and executing the wonderful meals for us. Thank you, Michelle. P.S. Her sticky date pudding is to die for. You made sticky date pudding? Any left? No, you've all eaten it, I'm sure. Very good. That is why people were sleepy this afternoon. I wonder why they're all sloth and torpor. Very good. Well done, Michelle. I'll keep that one for you afterwards. Dear Ajahn, can you do the loving kindness guided meditation on Saturday morning? Please. Thank you, Your Roundness. Stay in the present moment. Saturday morning is tomorrow. Stop going into the future. No, after tomorrow. I don't know what day it is. If the conditions are right, it will happen. But if you want it, it will not occur. How do I overcome my fear during meditation? I try, but I just lack the courage, especially when I come see you with my problems. With my problems, patterns? I know. So, especially when I can't come to see you with my something. What do I do? Is the path always so difficult with so many obstacles? Please, help. Okay, it's very easy. Because one day you have all these fears and you wonder what's going to happen. And some days it just happens and you can't stop it. Even though you're scared, why is this happening? It becomes so automatic, you go into these deep stages, you can't stop it, and you go through and you realize, what the heck was I scared of? It's beautiful. Because I already mentioned to you this idea of will and thinking you're in control of all of this. You're not. I am. At this retreat anyway. It's amazing just how you influence people without them knowing. But I influence you in good ways. So what happens sometimes, because of all the suggestions, sometimes that you're meditate, sometimes, you know, almost like your guard, your controller just gets a bit weak. And just all those ideas which you've heard, all those methods you've listened to, they take over. And I mean, many people have said this to me. Sometimes they're sitting there when you least expect it because you're not controlling it. You're sitting there and all these amazing things happen. You see these incredible lights. Maybe you've never seen them before, but this time you see big ones. You just can't help it. You can't stop it. Yeah, it's scary, but you still go in anyway. And it just happens. And so a lot of times, whether you're scared or not scared, it's going to happen, so you might as well let go and enjoy the ride. There is, I think the last retreat I gave or somewhere, I think it was last retreat here, that must have been last in the Easter retreat. I always give this simile that sometimes meditation is like you're driving along in the heavy traffic on some ECP in sort of Singapore, and I'm sitting next to you in the passenger seat. And you're driving along maybe 90 kilometers, 100 kilometers an hour, busy traffic, and I say, take your hand off the steering wheel. Go on, take your hand off. Take your feet off the pedals. See what happens. I can't do that. I'm in busy traffic. I'm going to crash. I said, no. Take your hands off the steering wheel, the feet off the pedals. See what happens. And that's what it's like in meditation. Now, I'm telling you to do stupid things, to let go of control. But after a while, you do it. And you find that, you know, you don't crash in meditation. This is only a simile. Don't do that in Singapore. And don't do that while you're flying the jets, you know. Just keep your hands on the... But this lady, she heard that so many times. She said that she had this dream. This dream that she was going about 200 kilometers an hour in a vehicle heading for a cliff. And I was sitting next to her. And as I was sitting next to her in this dream, She was laughing when she was telling me it happened. She said, "You told me as I was going towards this cliff and I was terrified, take your hand off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, see what happens." And both of us went over this cliff. And as we were careering down the cliff, she saw at the bottom of the cliff there was a road. But the road had this almost 90 degree sharp turn. I said, "Even if we make it to the bottom, there's no way this car can turn like that if I don't put my hand on the steering wheel." I said, no, hand off the steering wheel. And the car went at great speed all the way down the cliff. You know, it bounced and then automatically turned right and went along the road. And no, on the left-hand side, no trouble at all. He said, "Wow, you're right, Ajahn Brahm." And that was her dream, because she'd heard this so many times. And that's what happens in your meditation too. The impossible. When you let go of control, you think, it's all going to go wrong, I'm going to crash. But you don't. You know, you take the curves, you go down cliffs, anything happens, and you're perfectly safe. And that was mean that she had the faith and the courage that when lights came up and strange stuff happened, she would just go with it and enjoy every moment of the journey. Anyway, plane exploding in midair. One more thing. If it falls into the sea, the fish get to eat you. If it falls in the jungle, the animals have a free meal. Payback time. Oh, that was, you know, remember that story I said, the three advantages of dying in an aircraft explosion at 36,000 feet? Remember that? I've told that so many times. What's the first advantage? Instant cremation. You don't have to get a funeral director and pay them lots of money. You don't have to invite all your relations and feed them, and even feed people who aren't your relations. You don't know who they are, but they come in and they get a free meal anyway. You know, funerals in Singapore and Chinese funerals and all this takes days. And you have to take time off work. It's bad for the economy. And number two, what's the second advantage? Insurance payout, yeah. You don't lose money on your grandma's funeral. You actually make some funds out of it because, you know, you don't have to pay for anything, but you get insurance from the airline. And the last benefit? Close to heaven, it's easy to go the rest of the way. You know, you're almost there, 36,000 feet. And now this is the fourth one. The animals, if it's in the sea, the fish get to eat you. And if it's in the jungle, the animals have a free and easy meal. You know, it's barbecue too, it's just because, you know, it's toasted by the time it gets down there. So, you know, it's just nice. I told you it's good to feed the wild animals. And I did hear that they are searching for the missing Malaysian plane again. Do you know what happened to it? I told you my theory. I told lots of people my theory. There's only one person I know of who can make a jet aircraft disappear. David Copperfield. He did it. Sorry. Can you talk about confession practices in Buddhism? Yes. You come to see me and confess all the biscuits and noodles which you've eaten in the evening, you naughty Singaporeans. Do you think I don't know what goes on? You don't need to confess, I already know. But the whole point is confessing to yourself, not to anybody else. Now be honest with yourself. And when you're honest with yourself, no guilt, no hiding, no punishment. I've mentioned that to you earlier on. And when you're happy to admit your faults, then you learn from them and you grow from them. There's no problem anymore. And the guilt thing and punishment comes from confession. And I don't want to confess. Why? Because you're afraid of some punishment or pain or losing your self-esteem or whatever it is you're losing. And then why do that? Just confess. Just bring it up. Everyone makes mistakes. I make mistakes. You make mistakes. We all make mistakes. So what's the big deal? Just think, what's another mistake I made? What's the most recent mistake I made, monks? Come on, you can tell me. It makes me laugh as well. Remember anything I did which was really silly and stupid during the rains? I'm sure there must be something. Oh, was it there? Now, there was a naughty joke I remember saying to Angie, and the mother-in-law joke. And she said, that was sick, how'd you from? So that joke, which I said, it was a bad joke, I shouldn't have really sent it. There was... I've got to confess it, I've got to tell you what it is. There was these daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law, they never got on together. So, you know, their church group, or the Buddhist Fellowship, a great thing for the Buddhist Fellowship to do. Because, you know, daughters-in-law and mothers-in-law always have problems. So they decided to have a camp, you know, a Dharma camp, especially for mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law, so they could bond together, understand each other, talk about their problems, and have a better relationship afterwards. A really good idea. So the mothers-in-law went in one bus, you know, so they wouldn't sort of argue with the daughters-in-law in the other bus, and went to the camp. But unfortunately, on the journey, the bus with the mothers-in-law in it had a crash, and everyone was killed. They lost all their mothers-in-law. And just one of the ladies, now most people were very upset, but one of the ladies was crying more than the others. She said, don't worry, you all have to die, and you never got on with your mother-in-law anyway. And she said, that's not why I'm crying. I'm crying because my mother-in-law missed the bus. You're sick! I thought that was a bad joke and I said it. So that's what I confess, I tell bad jokes. Poor mothers-in-law. Anyway, so if you make a mistake, just let somebody know. And one of the things I've been telling this when, you know, people get married and I have the opportunity of giving them a blessing. One of the things I told them recently is, can you rise to the occasion and have a rule in your marriage of amnesty? As long as your partner tells you the truth. I mean, anything, you know, bad stuff, they've had an affair or they've spent too much on the credit card or whatever. As long as you tell me the truth, darling, I will never argue with you, scold you, shout at you, hit you, or anything. Because the truth is more important than anything else in marriage. So, you know, if the husband, you know, he has a quick flirt with one of the girls in the office and kisses her or something, you know, he can go and tell his wife, darling, I did something really bad. You know, I kissed the girl in the office, which I liked. And I'm telling you that because I want your help so I don't do it again. That's what a marriage is about, to support one another. And both of you are weak. And you make mistakes. And the husband wouldn't do that. You know why? Because you get hit, or you get shouted at. Wife would go ballistic. Well, it's a shame when that happens. Because when we make a mistake, we really need our wife's help. Or the wife makes a mistake, needs her husband's help. The relationship, the marriage is important. I want it to work. No, I've done something stupid. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. And they won't tell their loved one because they're afraid. And that's really sad. Wouldn't it be wonderful? You say, husband, wife, look, as long as you tell me the truth, I won't punish you. Or when they have kids, girls get pregnant and they shouldn't do. You know, the sons, they get involved in drugs. Will they tell their father if they're having trouble with drugs? No, because they're scared of their father. And the time they need their parents most of all, they're too terrified to ask for help. And I know that because even here in Australia, first time this happened, a young lady, I've known her for many years, she was pregnant, Sri Lankan girl, you know, with her boyfriend, and she came to talk to me. She says, I said, well, haven't you told your parents yet? He said, no, my dad will kill me if he found out that I'm pregnant. And she said, that's your job. That's what I came to see you for. You had to get her out of trouble, so you do those things for the people. But that really, that's terrible. A time when a girl needs her parents most of all. You know, she's made a mistake, she's pregnant, and she's afraid of them. So some of the girls would not even come to me, they'd just go and get some abortion somewhere, feel guilty and just hide it from the parents. And that's a terrible situation. Or, you know, your son, you know, he goes out with his friends and they take a few drugs and they get into trouble. The time when he needs his parents most of all, he's afraid that his parents will punish them. So they don't say, and they get deeper into trouble. So in a family, it's wonderful when we have amnesty. So people are free to confess. Dad, I got into big trouble. You know, I was at a party, someone gave me some pills and I took them, the police came. I've got to appear in court tomorrow. I'm sorry, Dad. But they come there because they want your help. And they're not afraid to come and ask you. Many boys would hide it because they're afraid of what their dad would say. Girls in trouble would hide it because they're afraid. And that's so sad. So if you ever have kids, or you've got kids, can you actually take them aside and say, look, now, whatever you do, son, daughter, you know, you get into big trouble, you embarrass me, you steal, or whatever. You know, I'm your mum, you know, I'm your dad. You can tell me anything. And I won't punish you, I won't scold you, I'm here to help you. And look after you, see if I can get you out of trouble. That's my job, not make more trouble for you. And then you have this beautiful family. And of course, husband and wife as well. You all make mistakes sometimes. And it's not just the husband's fault, the wife's fault as well. You know, you're both to blame. But when it happens, tell each other. And it's such a relief, you know, to tell the person you love the bad thing you've done. Such a relief to do that. And to be understood. That your partner can open the door of your heart, her heart or his heart to you, no matter what you've done. That's so liberating and freeing. So that's what confession is. Only happens when there's amnesty. When the love, the trust in one another is more important than wanting to punish or shout at the person. Anyway, Ajahn, please share with us what's happening at Katina this Sunday. It's our first time. If I share with you what's going to happen, it won't be exciting. That'd be like telling you what's at the end of the novel. You know, who sort of did the murder? You know, how sort of Superman is going to save the world? You don't want to see that until it actually happens. I will take away your excitement and the sense of adventure. So, who knows what's going to happen on Sunday? Wait and see. Well, it's interesting. We all want it to be planned out. We all want to know what's going to happen. And we have no sense of adventure anymore. That's why you get depressed in life. You know, you know what's going to happen, you know what jokes Ajahn Brahm is going to say, the stories, then there's no point in coming anymore. So don't plan everything and learn how to love insecurity. Isn't that wonderful? Just enjoy not knowing what's going to happen next. Then life has got taste. It's like sticky date pudding to die for. People that I have done wrong and people that have done wrong to me often come to my mind. How do I know I have forgiven myself and them? What should I do when such thoughts appear? People who have done wrong and people who have done wrong to me often come to my mind. If they've done wrong to you, thank them for teaching you something. Remember when I complained about the mosquitoes to Ajahn Chah, he said, call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. The person who cheated you out of all your wealth, call them Ajahn, thief, or whatever their name was, the one who took over the company or didn't pay the bills, so you went bankrupt. The person who ran away with your girlfriend, thank them. You know that my girlfriend, she wanted to go out with somebody else. Thank you, guy, for taking away this girlfriend. So instead of enemies, they become your friends. Thank you so much for teaching me things. Then you haven't just forgiven them, you've known them, what they've done. They've taught you so much. Sometimes maybe your husband divorced you, but if he hadn't done that, you'd never become a Buddhist. You never come to the Buddhist fellowship, you never do meditation or whatever. You know, sometimes you get a really bad body, you know, got all these diseases, you think, why me? Why can't I have a body like everybody else? If you had a body like everybody else, you wouldn't know how to meditate so well. So thank you, body, for being sick. So it's not just forgiving, it's understanding. Things and people you thought were your enemies now become your teachers. Ajahn, it is not death that I'm afraid of. It's what happens after that I fear. The uncertainty and the long struggle with death. Number one, why are you afraid of what happens after death? Are you good people? Now you must be good people to have enough good karma to get through the ballot of the BF. And get here. Now you've got good karma. So you're good people. And I know many of you, you know, you're generous, you're kind, you help out. And I've known many of you for years. You are good people. And even those I don't know, the fact you come here with these other good people must mean that you're, you know, birds of a feather flock together, so you must be good. So you're all good people. So what happens to good people when they die? Go to heaven, nice place. What are you afraid for? And so I gave that simile some time ago. Suppose that the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, because this is my 40th year as a monk, special, 40 years as a monk, and to celebrate that, you know, at the Katina Day on Sunday, we are going to give a prize. And the prize is, to all those who came on retreat are eligible, that you get a free holiday, maybe we'll say to say Los Angeles, say, flying not first class, suites class on Singapore Airlines for you and your partner. And you're going to stay 14 days in the swankiest 6-star hotel in Los Angeles. And the Buddhist Society of West Australia is going to arrange for you to have dinner every evening for whatever Hollywood star you like, whether it's Angelina Jolie or Brad Pitt or whoever you like, you can actually have dinner with every evening. And $5,000 a day for shopping. And you find that you won that prize. And in 2 weeks' time, you'll be going to LA, flying suites, 6-star hotel, meeting your favorite, you know, movie stars, and having dinner with them, you know, in a swanky restaurant, just, you know, 2-on-1 or 1-on-1 or whatever you want, and $5,000 every day just spending money in the shops. Would you be excited? Would you be thinking, only 14 days to go, only 10 days to go? Only 3 days to go. Yeah, bring it on. Can I go early, please? And the night before you're about to fly off, you'd be so excited you probably won't be able to go to sleep. Now, which is better? You know, the free gift offered by the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, you know, suites class to LA, 6-star hotel, Hollywood movie stars, $5,000 to spend a day. Is that better or going to heaven? Heaven is much better than that. So when you understand this simile, the doctor says, you've got 14 days to live. Yes! 14 days and I'm going to heaven! You know, 10 days before, can we bring it on faster, please, doctor? And the night before you're about to die and go to heaven, you won't be able to sleep that night. You'll be so excited. I'm going to die tomorrow. I'm going to heaven. Wow, yes, I can't wait. Now, when you put it like that, who's afraid? So people are really weird. The only thing is because you're conditioned by our culture to be afraid of dying. Total, no conditioning, brainwashing. Nothing wrong with dying. You've done it many times before. I often say that Buddhists, we are the experts on dying. Christians have only done it once. We've done it hundreds of times. Buddhists have experience. I better, oh crikey, I'm doing too much. What is the meaning of the nature of things? The Buddha's more is saying, please explain, thank you. The nature of things, that's a word like for Dhamma, it's a truth. The fact that, you know, the world sucks, that's the nature of things. The fact that, you know, all you girls who try to find a partner in life and it hasn't worked out, and you try and get another one, you will find out the nature of men. They are all the same. Those of you who have got a partner, stick to them. You know, you change them, swap them for somebody else, exactly the same. So it's a waste of time. Might as well stay with the one you've got. Girls, women. I know all about women. They are also the same. They may have, as I often say, they may have a different chassis. The motor is the same. So if you've got one and you're married, just stick with her. You know, you try and get another one, it's more of the same. So, and also it costs a lot of money going through divorces and getting married and stuff like that. So save money, save time, you know, save a lot of suffering and just have the suffering you've got instead of trying to get some. That's what they say, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. The suffering, you know, in your marriage is much better than the suffering in the bush. I don't know. Anyway, what has the stream, and that's the nature of things, by the way. What has the stream enterer realized to make him or her rebirth in a, him or her will not be rebirthed in a lower realm? They've learned not to punish themselves, to let go of guilt. And that part of the sense of self which owns the past, you've let go of. It's not yours. You've let it go. If you don't own the past, you don't have to be punished for the past. And the idea, also the wisdom, that punishment is counterproductive. You never get good results. Instead, you acknowledge, forgive, and learn. And that's growing. That's what a stream winner learns. Does he, she realize impermanent sufferingness on non-self? Yeah, that's the technical way of saying it. If I recall correctly, Sutta mentioned that one only needs to meditate on one of these three characteristics, impermanent suffering, non-self, and one get enlightenment. Can walking meditation lead to enlightenment? It depends on which direction the walking path goes. Yeah, of course it does. But what happens, the way to get enlightenment is not the walking meditation path, it's the eightfold path. Always eightfold path, okay? That's the path of enlightenment. And it's true, all of those impermanence, suffering, non-self. Actually, I'll talk about that tomorrow. That's a good thing for tomorrow. Impermanent suffering and non-self. Any one of those will do because they're all aspects of the same thing. Dear Ajahn, these few days are so surreal. How do we cope and sustain when we go home? Easy, don't go home. Who knows? Don't go in the future. You're not home yet. You haven't left yet. You've got another couple of days to go. Forget about it until it happens. And look, all of you who are leaving, you're not allowed to pack your bags until 1 hour before you're leaving this place. Sometimes people, they start packing their bags 2 days before. They haven't left yet. And then day before, you know, we're leaving on Saturday, so Friday evening, you're already packed. You haven't gone yet. Goodness sake, just don't pack until the last moment. Enjoy every moment. Ajahn Brahm, if there is non-self, then who exactly is meditating here? The same person who writes this question. If one is not the same person a second ago, why practice since no one is benefiting here? Exactly, stop practicing, stop doing things. I'm just being content. What are you trying to prove? And who's trying to prove it? So, see if you can just let go. No one in here. When there's no one in here, you can sit here perfectly happy. And because you're perfectly happy, because you want nothing, because there's no one to want anything, then you just become still. Because you become still, you can become, all these nimittas keep coming up, you get blissed out because you don't want anything. When you don't want anything, there's no one in here, there's no more wind blowing the leaf, so the leaf comes to perfect stillness and you enjoy yourself to the max. And if there is non-self, if you realize non-self, you don't write questions such as this anymore. So, if I can't remember my past life, the present me is practicing for a future life that I won't even remember in the future. Why practice? It's not why practice, why not? That's always the answer to why, the question why. The answer is, why not? You've got nothing else to do, that's why. What else are you going to do here? That's why practice, you've got nothing else to do, and you get bored even. It's like, you can't have no TV to watch, you can't allow, not allowed to talk, you know, there's no internet connection for you, so you've got no choice. Right? Just, well, I might as well practice, who cares? That's why you practice. Dewajan Brahm, you mentioned the only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. Yes, you've got it. How about the Pure Land teaching? According to Abhidharma, that's not Abhidharma, according to Amitabha, not Abhidharma. Close enough, though. Can they get enlightened in the Pure Land? I remember reading about the Pure Land. In the Pure Land, you get everything you want as soon as you want it. It's all wanting again. They say, you have a thought, you want to listen to Jimi Hendrix, and it's right there. If you don't like Jimi Hendrix, you want to see Elvis Presley, and he just appears. In the Pure Land, you want to have your favorite food. What is your favorite food? Now you're suffering, you see. Just thinking about it. But in the Pure Land, as soon as you think about it, it's right there. And not just an ordinary, just your special. From the special restaurant, the best restaurant, whatever you think you like, it's right there for you in the Pure Land. And what else can you get? In the Pure Land, you know, whatever Dhamma talk you want, it's right there for you. You don't have to come all this way from Singapore, it's just right there for you. Anything you want, it's right there for you. Wanting. It's not freedom from wanting. It's the freedom of desire in the Pure Land, not the freedom from desire. That's why if you understand the Dhamma, that's totally ridiculous. That's just some heaven realm which just makes you sort of more attached. Never understand what's going on. There's no way you can get enlightened from there. It's just like a holiday camp, you know, where you just don't do anything. So the Eightfold Path, that's what the Buddha said. Wherever there's the Eightfold Path, there's enlightenment. I have heard your talk on mindfulness many times. I enjoyed the last, but this time I understand. Wow. Underlined. I know now to be mindful of the present moment and to guard against defilements. Very good. Another satisfied customer. Dear Ajahn, in this wonderful retreat and at times in our hectic working life, boredom arises. What could be the causes? Please advise. So you get bored. Have you ever investigated boredom? No, really looked at it very closely. Almost like do research. What does it feel like? When you're bored, what do you feel boredom in the body? Is it sort of registered somewhere in the body? Does your toes feel bored? Or is it in your nose? What feels bored? And does boredom always stay the same? Or does it change? You know, get really deep boredom and then not so bored. You know, does it alternate just with every minute? Is boredom always the same feeling? And after a while, you get really interested in boredom. Boredom is fascinating. And as soon as you get fascinated and interested in boredom, you're not bored anymore. That's how I get out of boredom. I say, wow, this is interesting. What am I feeling now? This boredom stuff, you know, what is it? So when you get insight into it, it just disappears pretty quickly. It's one of Mara's, you know, most stupid of tricks. Once you know it, it just goes. So do an investigation into boredom. See how long it lasts. So when you're bored, the clock, 9:09, okay. How long can I be bored? Once you get interested in it, it doesn't last a second. That's the way to overcome it. But when you're bored, I don't want to be bored. Why am I bored for? This is terrible. I don't want... That makes boredom stay. But when you're kind to the monster, boredom comes into your house. Welcome, boredom. You know, it's been weeks since I've been really bored. Thank you for coming back again. So when you welcome boredom, it's not boring anymore. What is the art of happiness other than through meditation? All the talks I've given so far, and you still don't know? Oh, gee. What is the art of happiness? Why is it an art? Why can't you say a science, or a philosophy, or a religion? Why do they call it the art of happiness? It's not the art of happiness. It's a being of happiness, the isness of happiness. You don't have to paint it or create it, because art is what, you know, human beings create. That's why I don't like the word art of happiness. It's the isness of happiness. And that gives you more understanding of what it really is. But apparently, when I was thinking that, I thought, someone's going to mention I wrote a book called The Art of Disappearing. Because you can't say the isness of disappearing. It has to be the knownness of disappearing or something. But anyway, that was not my title. That's Ajahn Brahmani, so blame him. If you make a mistake, always pass the buck. There's always someone you can blame. If I say something wrong, I can blame my teacher. Well, that's what Ajahn Chah taught me. It's nothing to do with me. But whenever I say something really cool and inspiring, then any praise, always accept it. My mistakes are someone else, but my... all my successes, that's me. I am the most humble monk. My humility is legendary. Everybody knows how humble I am. I say, if you're humble, flaunt it. What's the point of being humble if you can't let people know? Okay, good way. Ajahn, is it... I really have to share this with everyone. Whoa, this is fascinating. Ajahn talked about the tarantula story, the film. There really was one in my room, toilet, and window still. They don't have tarantulas in Australia. That was probably a huntsman. And they're really cute. You can tickle them. And they go, now, they never bite you, they're fine. They're all over the place, huntsman spiders, and they're fine. When I attended your retreat in Penang, after you told that story about the grasshopper, there was one right in my windowsill too. So tonight I will tell ghost stories. Oh, don't tell ghost stories, Jabab. In the Anapanasati Sutra, it states, liberating the mind, you breathe in. Shouldn't the breath have disappeared by this point? The breath is you don't know the breath is happening at this point. It don't say you breathe in, it says breathing in. The breath is going in, you're liberating the mind. The breath is going out, liberating the mind. The heart is pumping, you're liberating the mind. You know, the blood is circulating, you're liberating the mind. You don't know the blood is circulating, you're not paying attention to that. And liberating the mind is entering the jhanas, that's what that one means. So it's just a way of Pali. How can I identify and get aware of the knower practically? Thanks for your detailed advice. Once you get rid of the doer, that's the only thing left, the knower. That is precisely what jhana does. You're not doing anything at all. All thoughts vanish. That's the other thing with jhana. No thinking, no sort of giving yourself advice or taking notes mentally. Your mind is now perfectly still. Not a thought goes on in your mind for hours. Perfectly still, blissed out. What's left is the knower. The doer's vanished. If you want to find out the nature of, say, gold, this is the Buddha simile, you've got to get rid of all of the other defilements in the gold. Now, I think gold has a lot of tin in it, apparently, sometimes. So, you know, you refine the gold until it's 100% pure gold, with no other elements in there except gold. Once you have pure gold, then as a chemist, you can find out its properties. But when it's, you know, mixed up with other stuff, you don't know what its true properties are. So when the knower is mixed up with the doer, you can't really understand what its properties are. But once the doer is totally vanished, there's only the knower left for hours. Then you can get to know it and find out who you really are. Do you not want to know who you really are? Tomorrow morning, all will be revealed. Exciting, isn't it? We always have, you know, do you watch soap operas and these TV shows where they have episode 1, 2, 3? So the last episode will be tomorrow. And the finale on Saturday will be just summing all up. The last episode of Eightfold Path will be revealed tomorrow morning. Woohoo! Exciting, isn't it? I'll try to make it interesting. Something, so thank you for I will die for sure. This works as all the hatred and resentment which keeps me awake at night from the corporate world vanishes. It helps to bring on the peace in mind. I will keep this mantra in my mind. Very good. And if there is someone you really hate, you can alter the mantra to you will die, that's for sure. That also works. Please don't put that on the tape. I'm going to be in big trouble for that one again. Anyway, our last one, another one for the cook. Yes. Dear Sister Michelle, I have been fantasizing about hot, savory Chinese soup every time I sit to meditate. Thank you for the wonderful hot savory vegetable soup today morning. Wonderful, thank you. Whoever wrote that, which would you prefer? Jhana or hot savory Chinese soup? By laughing, you've told me the answer. Forget about jhana being on the soup. Okay, very good. You can have both, win-win. Have beautiful soup or beautiful, what was the sticky date pudding, and jhana at the same time in this retreat. What a wonderful service. Great food, silly talks, great meditation, bliss. Sadhu. 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 Okay, very good. So good night, everybody. Have a nice rest and dream of hot, savory Chinese soup. Oh, is it? There you go. Oh, Claire, could you give this to Michelle?
Yes.
That's Michelle's ones. Very good. You can go whenever you want because I'm staying here tonight. Or tomorrow night, Friday night, I'll be giving the talk at Nolamara Center. So tomorrow night, Ajahn Bhamani will be answering your questions. So, variety, the spice of life. So please make them hard.